Okay, the situation at the moment, when we look at the Middle East, is just shocking beyond words. When you see the pictures of emaciated children, you see the people blown up by Israeli bombs, the starvation, the 60,000 killed already, shows us, I think, the horror beyond comprehension. I guess a lot of people are probably struggling to make sense of it all. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, we've seen 3.5 years of war now with hundreds of thousands of people killed on both sides. Military budgets are rising around the world into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And then there is a nuclear threat, which is rising by the week. We're seeing recently the 80th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, which tells us where the nuclear arms race can end up. So war exposes the barbaric, blood-soaked truth at the heart of capitalism. But it's also true there's always been opposition to war. We saw it recently in the marches across the country, more than 300,000 people coming out against Israel's war in Palestine. Looking further back, there was the 2003 demonstrations against the invasion of Iraq, 800,000 people showing up across Australia. These anti-war protests are significant, not just because the momentum they can build in terms of stopping the war in Ukraine, in Iraq, in Vietnam, in elsewhere, but also because there's been a solid link between such wars, anti-war movements, and revolutions. So every big warmonger claims to be motivated by humanitarian ideals or a desire to halt aggression by another power. It's always a defensive war. No matter how many countries you listen to, how many governments, every contending power says they're fighting their own national defense. In reality, what they're doing is trying to extend their own national interests in an increasingly unstable world. And the United States is right at the fore, the bloodiest of the butchers. Barely a day has gone by in the last few decades where the United States has not been causing carnage somewhere. During the Cold War, the United States invaded, destabilized, overthrew governments, and installed right-wing dictatorships in Central Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East. In 2001, the United States said it would liberate Afghanistan. Far from bringing peace, the US-led invasion created 200,000 dead. The United States' 2003 invasion of Iraq unleashed yet more terror. By the time it ended, the occupation, 8 years long, had cost around 500,000 lives, which is actually another 500,000 in addition to those killed by US sanctions the previous decade. Special mention, though, must be made of the US support for Israel. In just the first 12 months of the current war, the United States gave Israel $18 billion in direct military aid and spent another $5 billion on military operations supporting Israel. Now, this isn't because the United States is Israel's lapdog or because of the power of the Israel lobby. It's because Israel is a big asset for American imperialism. The US and its allies look to Israel as a secure bastion that will do the West dirty work. Israel will always back the United States in its fight to maintain its power in the Middle East. Now, the US may be the most aggressive imperialist power on the planet, but it's not the only one. We can add Britain, France, Germany, China, Russia, all leading imperialists. Well, even Australia is a mid-sized imperialist power. Socialists don't distinguish between them. They'll all want to extend their power to grab resources, territory, and all of them must go. This is why the United Nations is no solution to a world of war and militarism. Its Security Council is made up of the biggest thieves of the lot. So how can we explain war and militarism? And Marxists argue that the drive to war is intimately tied up with the operation of capitalism. Imperialism isn't just an aggressive policy pursued by Benjamin Netanyahu or Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin. Imperialism as a form of advanced capitalism has taken since the late 19th century. That was a period when huge companies were emerging in all the big powers, in which all the advanced governments and powers fought it out with others to dominate the world markets. These companies didn't just try to outcompete their rivals on the basis of price or the quality of the good or whatever, but they looked to their governments to help them. Now, sometimes this was a matter of diplomacy, but increasingly it became a matter of military force. Those who fell behind in the new arms race were crushed underfoot. Now, battles over markets in the colonial world were quickly translated into battles in the heart of the system in Europe. So to define things clearly, imperialism describes the condition of modern capitalism in which advanced capitalist states compete peacefully and by military means to dominate the world market on behalf of the capitalists in their territory. So turning now to imperialist competition today, the United States, as I said before, is the world's biggest superpower, the world's biggest, toughest bully on the block. But it's now facing tough competition from China. The prize is control over the Asia Pacific, which is a vital hub for the world economy. And it's this contest between the United States and China that defines the world today. Why the United States and its allies are undertaking naval drills off the coast of China, why the fastest growth of military spending in the world is in the Asia Pacific region, including China, why the Albanese government is ratcheting up military spending, ordering nuclear submarines, and setting up American military bases in Northern Australia. Australia is not being dragged into this growing military competition. Australia has been at the forefront, in fact, in encouraging American militarism in the Asia Pacific. Just take AUKUS. This nuclear submarines project was actually the brainchild of Scott Morrison and British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who drafted the whole project and then took it to the Americans. The Americans were only kind of half committed to it, as you can tell, in fact, that Donald Trump has ordered a review into the nuclear submarines. So, in fact, this was very much an aggressive project by the Australian government, backed up by the British government. It was not forced on Australia by the Americans. And the same was true in the Vietnam War. It was Australian Prime Minister Menzies that encouraged American President Lyndon Baines Johnson to dispatch more armed forces to Vietnam in the 1960s. So this sounds like quite counter to what you normally hear, which is Australia is just a little kind of weakling country that gets bossed around by America. In fact, Australian governments, both Liberal and Labor, do their best, in fact, to drag the United States into the region because they regard American supremacy in the Asia Pacific as a precondition for the prosperity of Australian capitalism. Both the United States and China, when we look at the Asia Pacific today, are sharpening their swords to prepare for war. That's what explains the military buildup we can see, the growing bellicose rhetoric we see in both sides. Now, imperialist competition doesn't just involve tanks, missiles, nuclear submarines, but also trade wars. They help to explain what's going on with tariffs. So a lot of commentators look at what Donald Trump is doing with his tariffs and say it's utterly crazy. All it's doing is pushing up the cost of production, fueling inflation in the United States. But actually, there's more to it than just some basic economic competition. It's actually all about military competition. The fact that the United States has, for the last four decades, pursued a project of free trade, neoliberalism, deregulation, whatever name you want to give it. In doing so, the American companies have basically offshored a lot of production to China, and they now face a situation where, in the event of a war, actually some of the main military supplies and components are going to be coming from the enemy. So the United States, actually, not just Trump, but actually starting with Biden, what works out is you now need to rebuild the American military industrial base in order to have the artillery, the shells, the submarines, the warships, and so forth to fight a war with China. And America is actually starting a long way behind, particularly when you look at its Navy, which is going to be the crucial component of any war in the Asia Pacific. So Trump's tariffs are actually aimed at building up those factories and the munitions capacity in the United States, the better to fight an imperialist war for control over that region. Whether or not that works is another matter, but we put that to one side. So we have to say, even though it hasn't really sunk into popular consciousness yet, that war between the United States and China is looking increasingly unlikely. It's looking increasingly likely, which may seem to defy common sense. After all, everyone knows they're both nuclear powers. Everyone knows that there's a war between the two. This could actually explode into a thermonuclear war with the deaths of millions of people, which is so catastrophic to beyond words. And the capitalists on both sides will actually be partly affected by it. They can't just stand in their nuclear bunkers forever. But nonetheless, this is actually part of the insane logic of capitalism. They are currently, at the moment, obviously not prepared to strike directly at the other party, but they are planning such a move sometime, maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, maybe 10 years. We don't really know. But the point about imperialist competition is that wars can break out without necessarily prior planning by either party. You look at the way First World War broke out, even the Second World War, to some extent, this was the pace of events, if you like, forcing both parties into the war. In some ways, they're predisposed to go to war with each other, such as the nature of military competition. But when they go to war, actually, the whole situation can take on a life of its own. So it may not be prior planning or conscious intervention to trigger the war like that. But there comes a point when both sides are butting up against each other and neither side can afford to back off. Because to do so is not just to lose the immediate battle with the rival, but also if you have pretensions to be the world superpower, to undermine your claim to supremacy. If the United States backs off in its contest with China, the whole US military alliances in Asia will crumble. because they'll all look to China rather than the United States. The United States knows this. If China backs off in such an event over a contest over Taiwan, that puts pay to its ambitions to have a bigger influence in the Asia-Pacific region. So there's no question but that the world is in a pretty terrifying situation at the moment, not just for Palestinians, but for all of us. Now, how do we stop the war then, which is, after all, the topic of this session? So one option is to say, well, look, can the Labour Party stop the war? After all, it's supposed to be for the people. But you only have to look at the Middle East to see why that's not the case. You only have to look at Europe to see why that's not the case. There's a drive for rearmament across Europe right now in hundreds of billions of dollars, and the Labour parties in Europe, they call social democratic parties, but I keep that short by calling them Labour parties. The Labour parties and the Conservative parties alike are actually fueling this arms drive. You only have to look at Starmer's Britain. You have to look at the Labour coalition governments in Germany, Sweden, and Denmark. They're all behind increasing military spending. So what are the kind of arguments they tend to use to justify this? Now, one is self-defense. We're all at threat of Putin's Russia. Look at Ukraine. That's what happens when you don't defend yourselves. But the idea that Putin's going to go to war with Britain, France, or Germany, it's just ridiculous. European members of NATO have four times as many warships, three times as many battle tanks, three times as much artillery, and twice as many fighter jets as Russia. So really, the argument about just self-defense, it's just, as I say, it's just rubbish. Basically, the situation is that the European powers are growing militarization in order to become bigger imperialist players themselves. Now, this same is true actually in Australia, where the Labour government argues to defend the nuclear submarines and so forth is to defend Australia against Chinese expansionism. Sometimes they put this in code. They call it about defend the rules-based order. But everyone knows what they're talking about. They're talking about the rise of China in the region. But the only reason why China might attack Australia, even though it's showing at the moment no signs of doing so, is because both Labour and coalition governments have invited Americans to set up military bases and to use Australia as a forward base for attacks on China. If your party was Chinese ruling class, actually, you've got to understand why you have to take out Australia. Because Australia is a forward base for US Marines, for Pine Gap, for American naval warships, for submarines. Then, from their point of view, Australia becomes a legitimate target. Bad luck to the Australian population. And the same is true for American attacks on China as well. So this US alliance, which is supposed to be protecting us all, actually is a threat to us all, because it makes more likely that Australia will become drawn into, in fact, quite possibly actually leading a challenge, a battle with China in the region. Now, there's another argument that comes up in relation to both Europe and Australia, which is that by building up their arms base, they can become more independent and strike a more independent path in relation to America. They no longer need to be kind of dragged behind America, as sometimes people put it. But this is to misunderstand why it is that Europe is actually rearming at the moment to the extent it is. This is not really, for the most part, in the immediate term at least, to become more independent of America. In fact, what it's to do is to actually spend more money to keep Trump happy, to make sure Trump keeps the American military in Europe. So there's not in any sense any kind of independent kind of foreign policy or independent defense. It's actually to entrench American military in Europe as part of the competition with Russia. But nonetheless, even if it were to develop an independent self-defense, so-called self-defense policy, even if it were to try strike a more independent imperialist positioning in relation to the United States, that's not something I think that socialists or the working class forces should celebrate. There's nothing positive to be said about the ambitions of British imperialism, for example, in the Middle East, French imperialism in Africa, or German imperialism in Eastern Europe. They are all rotten imperialist powers. They were, after all, the original colonial powers. So we stand against all of them, not just the United States, British imperialism, German imperialism, and French imperialism. And the same argument about independence and self-reliance also comes up in Australia when we talk about the AUKUS anti-AUKUS campaign. I was involved in some of the early planning meetings when we got getting some demonstrations off the ground. And probably the most common response in the anti-AUKUS campaign, often involving a lot of people back from the Vietnam generation and so forth, older people who were trained in a certain set of politics, which is kind of nationalist, they said, we shouldn't be having these nuclear submarines because they're embedded in a whole American war plans for China, which is entirely true. But they said what we should have instead is conventional submarines, and then we could patrol Australia and defend Australia. But they said they called us an independent foreign policy. They said it was defensive, not offensive. But really, whether conventional or nuclear, these submarines are all designed for warfare. And Australian imperialism is never about self-defense. We're never about just defending the mainland and Australian civilians in the way that you or I might understand it, you know, protecting us here at UQ or whatever. What they mean by defending Australia is actually about defending Australia's little empire all around our region. It means Papua New Guinea, it means the Pacific Islands, it means Indonesia. That's what our politicians and regional planners and military brass like to call our backyard. You see kind of coverage of the South Pacific. They always call it our backyard, securing our backyard. You know, the Prime Minister has been in Vanuatu, the Prime Minister has been in Solomon Islands, the Prime Minister has been in Papua New Guinea. They've just got some new arrangement. What's arrangement basically involves is ensuring Australia has either military bases or trains Papua New Guinea soldiers or whatever, actually as to entrench Australia as what they call the preferred security partner. That is the big brother for these nation states in relation to China. China itself, of course, is trying much the same thing. So striking up aid programs and so forth with just the same purpose. It's imperialist competition. The people of the region, the average Papua New Guinean, the average Tongan, the average person in Vanuatu, their interests do not come into it. It's basically a giant chessboard we now have in our region, which we are defending. Actually defending the interests of Australian capitalism and Australian imperialism, its long domination of our region as the strongest power in the South Pacific and Southeast Asia and Southwest Pacific. That's what they mean by self-defense. So if we talk about conventional submarines, this isn't actually protecting people sleeping in their beds in Brisbane. It's actually about extending Australia's influence, to some extent, Australian mining interests in places like Papua New Guinea, but more broadly, to secure the South Pacific for the broader American military alliance across the whole of the Pacific region. That's what Washington relies on Australia to do, to become the chief ally in this region and hold up people like our side of the equation, in return for which would be part of the Five Eyes, the security arrangements, preferred partner, nuclear submarines. It's all part of the Australian-American entanglement, which serves both parties. So we should basically have no interest, no truck with this idea about what we need, our own independent, defense forces or whatever, because it all comes down to the same thing. It all comes down to capitalist domination, the oppression of ordinary people. Now, some arguments have come up in Europe from some of the social democratic Labour parties that money shouldn't be taken out, that we should definitely have the rising military spending, but the money should not be paid for by cuts to social security or wages or welfare. They say we should have both guns and butter. And that's what the German social democrats are trying to say to their followers. Yes, we back the military expansion, but hey, we're actually ring-fencing the welfare state. But this is just, well, I said deluding themselves. They're probably not deluding themselves. They know very well what it is they're selling. They're trying to delude their followers. Because in reality, the German government, led by Merz, actually a conservative, but backed by the social democrats, the French government, led by Macron, are all already planning, or in some cases actually initiating cuts to the welfare state and cutting public spending. So we know that all this money towards the weapons and the military systems is going to come out of our pockets. It's going to come out of the pockets of the working class. As well, but even though you'd have to say, even if they held true to their word, even there was not one single dollar cut from Social Security, we should still oppose this. Because war, after all, who are its main victims? The working class, the people who get enrolled to fight, the people who are victims, the people who are there as a bond in the event of a war. Now, the truth is that Labour parties in places like Britain and Australia today back military spending for the same reason they backed their own governments, or in fact were governments in the case of Australia in both world wars, because they're pro-capitalist parties looking to govern capitalist nation states. If you argue against military spending, it means you're not just jeopardizing your profits, the arms companies. Sometimes people say, oh, it's just the arms companies. They're driving the world to war. No, it's a much bigger system than that. Why would the American government be shoving money to the arms companies? You know, it's not just because they're in their ear and they've got good lobby groups. It's because war serves the interests of the capitalist class and their own nation states. So if you oppose the military buildup, what you're doing is saying we don't want our nation state to be part of this mad chase of armaments and militarism. And if you do that, you're basically saying, like I said earlier, 20 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, about how imperialism works, you'll be pushed down the world's pecking order. And every capitalist nation state wants to make sure it rises up the imperialist pecking order, not getting driven down. So to the extent you want to play the game of capitalism, that means you get drawn into militarism. There is no alternative. And you also have to say these governments to say they are, practicing independent foreign policy, they're trying to avoid militarism and whatever. That actually, when it comes to a real anti-war movement, what are these governments doing? You only have to look at what they're doing in relation to the Palestine movement against Israeli atrocities. The German government has been persecuting Palestine activists. In Britain, the Starmer government has declared Palestine Action a terrorist organization. And of course, here in Australia, we've seen university vice chancellors, we've seen government ministers, we've seen police commissioners, we've seen courts, all the rest of them, all trying to smash the Palestine solidarity movement. So I'd say all the evidence is from Europe, from Australia, is we can't trust the Labour parties to stop this drive to war. But it's not just the Labour parties. Look at the German Greens, which when they were formed in 1980, were pacifists. But they're now one of the more hawkish parties in the German parliament. They backed a massive expansion of military spending, but add the caveat, so long as it doesn't interfere with the green transition. I mean, are these people nuts? The military is the single biggest contributor to carbon emissions on the planet. And any continental war, you don't have to imagine a mushroom cloud going up over Berlin, will have huge effects on the environment. Again, they're just trying to fool their supporters and say, yeah, we're actually still progressive. So you can see the pull that of militarism on any party that wants to work within the capitalism. You have to show you're a serious player. And being a serious player means agreeing to the whole arms race. It means agreeing to your country being up there in the pecking order of the imperialist powers. In the case of Australian Greens, for example, they recently released what they call a fully costed defence policy involving spending money on drones and missiles. Now, they're also talking about scrapping AUKUS. It's not like they're a totally gung-ho military party, you know, wanting to boom, you know, boost the military spending. But nonetheless, the idea that we should have an independent foreign policy, which is what the Greens say as well, actually all kind of is part and parcel of, number one, in the case of the Greens, wanting to show they can be a coalition partner with the Labour Party, and number two, demonstrating the ruling class and say, hey, look, yeah, we're a little bit radical in places, but we can be trusted. You can trust us with the keys to power because we know, you know, what you have to do in the end, which is we need a powerful military to defend Australian interests. Then there are the trade union leaders who back increased military spending on the basis that creates jobs. So we see this here in the AUKUS issue. We see union leaders in South Australia welcoming plans to build more submarines. They justify claims for higher wages on the basis of what they call the critical role of the defence industry. But if we're talking about job creation, much better to spend the money on public infrastructure for civilian uses, public transport, railways, housing, hospitals, and so forth. But the union leaders won't go for that option because, tired as they are of the Labour Party, they're just as nationalist, in fact, as the Labour politicians. They still believe in the need to rally behind the Australian ruling class. They still see themselves as being a player in that national political setup, which is framed around the interests of the capitalists. And in doing so, they only, in fact, weaken their ability to do what they claim to be doing, which is fighting to defend jobs. Because once you defend the idea of saying, well, we need a more powerful military, we need to build up the military industrial system, we need more naval shipyards to build weapons of mass destruction, well, when the government says to you, but hey, don't you need to take wage cuts because you know the economy needs them? Well, you've lost the argument already, haven't you? Because you've accepted the priorities of the system, which is the workers should be dragged behind the whole kind of capitalist priorities. So how then can we stop the drive to militarism and war? Now, you don't have to look too far to see the solution, or at least one step towards the solution. Just last weekend, I could have called for hands. How many people showed up at that huge rally in Brisbane? Was it 30,000, 40,000, 50,000? The biggest anti-war demonstration in Brisbane for 25 years or thereabouts, and people protesting all around Australia. And we've seen massive marches in places like London as well, making global headlines. We need much more of this kind of action, mass, inclusive, broad, and aimed at maximising pressure on our governments. Alongside this, we've seen cultural figures like NECAP ensuring the anti-war movement reaches a mass audience of young people and helping to normalise hostility to Israel as a default position of liberals and progressives. But it's when workers take power to halt the war industries that we see the most effective weapon against Israel. So just last month, for example, Unite, one of Britain's biggest unions, backed members refusing to build, handle, or transport weapons destined for Israel. Now, this is a step forward when unions get off the fence, as opposed to some other unions in Britain that actually backed the military war drive. But we must be clear that these kind of resolutions passed by big unions like Unite or TUC, I'm not sure the ACTU ever publishes such things, are really not much more than arse covering by the trade union leaders, coming under popular pressure to be seen to be doing something rather than nothing. So these resolutions tend to sit on the rule book, on the resolutions list, but not put in practice unless there is some kind of militant pressure from the workers themselves in those industries or in those logistics industries that connect with the military complex. Only strong militant grassroots unionism actually can give these resolutions some effect. Now, thankfully, we've actually seen that. You don't have to look at the waterfront workers. There's a whole range of countries across the world. We've got Belgium, India, Catalonia, Turkey, California, South Africa, Italy, Greece. All of them have taken action in the last 2 years to stop the supply of weapons to Israel, which is fantastic. But workers can also hurt the arms drive in other ways. They don't have to just be directly stopping the supply of weapons as a political moment, but also if they're in the arms industry, every time they go on strike, they actually help to screw the military drive to war. So, for example, in America right now, 3,000 Boeing workers are on strike, and they're the workers actually help make the F-15 and F-35 fighter jets. And in doing so, actually help to hold up the supply of these killer aircraft to the Israeli Defense Forces. So let's have a look at a couple of historic examples where workers have been set in motion in opposition to war. Something that's even more impressive and effective when revolutionary socialists win the leadership of these struggles. Because revolutionary socialists, unlike the Labour parties, unlike the Greens, we don't support our governments, we're internationalists. We don't support the so-called national interest, and we call bullshit when our rulers say they're going to war to defend the population. Only on that basis, those kind of internationalist politics, can you lead an intransigent fight against war and militarism. We saw this in 1917, when the Russian workers, soldiers and sailors rose in revolt under the leadership of the Bolshevik Party to end their country's involvement in World War I. That Russian Revolution inspired rebellious workers and soldiers across the world. And by the war's end, three major empires, the Russian, the Austro-Hungarian and the Ottoman Empire, had collapsed. The war had transformed the entire continent into a cauldron of revolution. And even here in Australia, in fact, in Australia, the anti-conscription movement was enormous, a very significant movement of anti-war agitation, twice halting the government's attempts to introduce conscription for the front lines. And 5 decades later, in the 1960s and 70s, American and Australian socialists helped lead a movement against the Vietnam War, bring tens of thousands of workers and students onto the streets, and contributing ultimately to the withdrawal of Western forces from Vietnam. The American top brass was so worried by the anti-Vietnam War, so worried that the soldiers in Vietnam were so infected by anti-war sentiment, they realized they were incapable of continuing their war and had to pull out. And socialists also campaigned in recent years, in the campaign against the Iraq war, and of course, in the Palestine movement. Socialist Alternative, the host of this conference, for example, were responsible last weekend for actually organizing a nationwide march for Palestine. That was our initiative, an indication of the sort of thing that internationalists and socialists can actually do, because we actually don't believe any lies that Israel uses to justify its war on Gaza, or more importantly, that the Australian government uses to justify its support for Israel. So to conclude that, we face a new situation today with a potential not just for a war in the Middle East, but in fact a world war involving the United States and China. And if this were to escalate into a nuclear war, obviously catastrophe would be upon us. It would simply become a fight for survival then. Therefore, we must build a revolutionary socialist movement big enough to hold back the drive to war. In Australia, that means primarily challenging the American war drive. It means opposing escalating arms spending, both in the US and in Australia. It means cancelling the nuclear submarines, shutting down Pine Gap. It means isolating and sanctioning Israel. The Labour Party, in government, and therefore obviously demonstrating what it will do, won't agree to any of these things, because to do so would threaten the vital interests of the Australian capitalist state. Preventing a future world war, therefore, which will bring horrors untold upon us, therefore entails a revolutionary struggle to smash capitalism. But as the Russian Revolution shows, it actually also requires the building of a mass socialist party with the kind of internationalist, anti-war, anti-national politics that can actually defeat all the arguments why we should accept the drive to war, why we should say, oh, China's our enemy, why we should support our boys, why we should support Pine Gap, why we should support nuclear submarines. Only if you have that kind of revolutionary conception of the world, only if you understand the need to mobilize the working class as the victims of this, only if you understand the capitalists as being the subjects of this war drive, can you actually, number one, help to build a movement against the war, and number two, fundamentally, lead it into a revolution that's ultimately successful to smash the capitalist system, which is taking us headlong into a catastrophic future of even more accentuated war and militarism that will make Gaza look like a picnic.